Hey guys, this is Candace.
And I'm Elaine.
And this is Cousins on Crime, and we're 5 years old. Oh my gosh. Hey guys, thanks for coming back to part two. We are getting crazy over here.
Yeah.
Now this is the second part of our episode on the McDonald family slayings. If you haven't listened to part one, you'll want to go on and listen to that first. We covered the background of the family. We covered the night of the murders. And the stuff that happened following the murders. And even though he was officially cleared by the military court of any wrongdoing in the crimes, the CID would not let go of building a case against Jeffrey McDonald. And at that point, even Colette's family had turned on him. So let's pick up where we left off, which is he was charged with three counts of first degree murder. Now, during the trial, from the jump, the trial judge seemed to not really care for Jeffrey's attorneys very much. Sorry, Jeffrey's attorney very much. He had denied all 24 motions that were filed by the defense.
24. Wow.
And just felt like Bernard Siegel was a bit theatrical and excessive. Did I mention the 24 motions that were denied? The defense had immediately claimed the double jeopardy defense, saying, well, hey, he was found not guilty in the Article 32 hearing. You know, that was conducted by the military. Well, the judge was like, go back to law school because that's actually not how it works. A hearing and a colonel can't actually find him not guilty, so it didn't work like that. Good try though.
Okay, bye.
The judge was rolling his eyes much of the trial when Jeffrey's attorney was up there. And you know, the jury picks up on stuff like that. And if a jury sees a judge behaving that way, it can really influence a verdict.
Yes.
On the stand, William Ivory, now remember he was in the CID. He's the one who immediately didn't believe Jeffrey's account of that night. Now, he described arriving on the scene and first observing Colette. Like I said in part one, he said that the master bedroom light was on, so he was able to observe Colette in her two-piece pink pajama set that was soaked in blood. She had a white bath mat laid across her abdomen, which he thought was interesting. And then he saw this blue cloth that was kind of draped over her chest, which was later determined to be Jeffrey's pajama shirt. And by the way, he poo-pooed any story of Helena and these hippies that apparently came in. He just didn't want any part of it. He said, I know Helena, like I've heard of her, and she's a space cadet. To quote William Ivory, he called her a space cadet. Which back in the 70s, that was an insult, okay? The jury thought it was odd that Dr. McDonald was very choked up on the stand, and at times he couldn't even speak. He was so upset. However, by all accounts, he never showed any emotion at any other time, not in any interview, like not the night of the murders, not after, not when he was questioned by the CID or civilian detectives, none of that. So they felt like it was an act. So, all of that considered, the jury deliberated for 6 hours, which, if you know your stuff, in a murder trial, that's not a good thing. And it
No,
was
right.
not a good thing for the defense. Jeffrey was found guilty of second degree murder in the murders of his wife, Colette, and his daughter Kimberly. Remember, they theorized that he just, in the heat of passion, killed Colette, accidentally killed Kimberly. So that was second degree murder. Well, he was found guilty of first degree murder in Kristen's death because they said he just, like, basically went in there and did that. It wasn't the heat of passion. It was thought out. So he was sentenced to the maximum, which was three consecutive life sentences. And Jeffrey was visibly stunned in the courtroom. He just, like, was like...
Like, now, he just didn't think he was going to get caught.
He really didn't think that he would be found guilty. He just really didn't. In 1980, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned his conviction on the basis that due to the delay in bringing him to trial, which was 9 years after the crimes, it was in violation of his right to a speedy trial. He was released from prison. He went on about his life, but that ruling was reversed in 1982 by the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was arrested again and returned to prison.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was like, sweet, I'm out, gonna live my life, do this thing. And then they were like, nah, you're not.
Yeah.
Now, in 1983, Fatal Vision was published by Joe McGinnis. When I started researching this case, I kept coming across the title Fatal Vision, and I was like, what does that even mean? Like, what does that have anything to do with this case? Well, the book didn't paint Jeffrey McDonald as a wrongfully convicted innocent man like he had wished it would. As we spoke about in part one, he was shopping around his story. He was trying to get someone to write the story of the murders and the fact that he was innocent and the fact that these other people did it. Well, Joe McGinnis saw something different. He painted Jeffrey McDonald as a sociopath that had visions of killing his family.
Oh.
Enter Fatal Vision. So Jeffrey was really pissed off about this, and he filed a civil suit against the author for breach of contract, fraud, and damages.
Okay.
Now, that suit ended in a mistrial, but Jeffrey did accept a $325,000 settlement from Joe McGinnis's insurance company, which probably just covered some of his attorney's fees. Really not a win there, but I guess... in some small way it is. But remember Detective Beasley? We talked about him in part one. He knew Helena Stokely as his drug informant.
Yes.
Well, in 1984, he gave a sworn declaration. This had nagged at him for many years after the conviction. So I'm going to outline what he recounts. And remember, he was out monitoring the drug traffic at the Village Shop the night of the murders, and I made that joke about Dunkin' Donuts, you know?
Right.
It was a really funny joke. Well,
yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, let's get into his sworn declaration. So he says that around 10:50 p.m. the night of the murders, he saw a blue Ford Mustang pull into the alley next to the Village Shop, and he saw Helena Stokely and a black male get out from the car on the passenger side. I guess the man was sitting in the front seat and he had got out of the car to let her out of the back seat, if that makes sense. So he just stood next to the car while she went into the shops. Now, at that time, Helena was an active informant for the Fayetteville Police Department, in particular Detective Beasley. And she was providing information about dealings around town. She was even ratting out some of her friends. She was, that night, she was wearing a long blonde hair wig and a floppy hat. Guess what the black guy was wearing?
Fatigues.
He was wearing an army jacket with an E16 insignia on it. Which in part one, we talked about the fact that this is exactly what Jeffrey described as the intruders wearing that night.
Right.
So Beasley noted that he had seen that black guy with Helena before. He had seen him wearing that same jacket before. He recognized him. He didn't know who he was, but he just recognized him as seeing him before with her. So about 10 minutes later, Helena comes out from the shops and they both get in the car and it pulls away. So he's like, okay, well, you know, and this, he doesn't know anything about the murders at this point. He's just out, you know, monitoring the drug traffic.
Patrolling. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the following morning, Detective Beasley gets a call from Captain J.E. Melvin notifying him of the murders that happened at Fort Bragg. Well, Captain Melvin described the suspects to Beasley just to kind of, you know, pick his brain. And he immediately believed that description to fit Helena and her boyfriend and the black male that was with them. Now, at the time, he didn't know the third guy. So he hit the streets looking for them. He was like, I know these people, that I'm going to be able to get a hold of them, get a confession. So it was the wee hours of the next morning. This was February 18th. He set up surveillance outside of Helena's apartment. Around 2:15 a.m., a faded yellow car with out-of-state plates pulled in.
Okay.
It was Helena and a couple of other guys. He couldn't really tell if there were two or three guys. It was dark and he just couldn't see, but he could see the other people in the car. Detective Beasley ends up pulling up and blocking their car in the parking space. And he like hollered out like something probably like, Helena, get your booty over here, something like that. I'm just kidding. I don't know what he said to her, but he called her over. And she starts walking over to his car and these guys are following her, like ready to go fisticuffs with, you know, this person in the car, like they were protecting her or something. Well, she's like, y'all chill. Okay. I'm gonna go talk to this guy. I know him. So the guys kind of hung back and went and stood over back by the car. Well, as Helena is approaching his car, she said she knew why he was there. She's like, look, I know why you're here. And she asked if he wanted to see her ice pick.
What?
He was like, are you joking? Or are you actually involved in the murders? Remember, this is one whole day and then in the wee hours of the morning later. So
gotcha.
The details of the case, they were not on the news, like murder weapons were not discussed. There was still a lot of information that was held close to the chest. Now, she said,
why after all these years is this being said?
Well, he did tell them back in that day.
Okay.
But the CID didn't believe him.
Didn't. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, this information was brought up at trial, but the jury was not there for this.
This was,
you know, how sometimes when the attorneys want to discuss something, they'll dismiss the jury for a little bit. Now, all of this was discussed while the jury was out, so they didn't get to hear any of this. Back to Beasley and Helena, he's like, are you serious? She's like, well, I think I was there. It was really awful. I was high. I don't remember. But like, I kind of remember it, but I could have been there, I mean, but I'm not sure.
When you're on drugs, I mean, you do crazy things. Like you turn into an animal, I've heard. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never experienced it.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. I don't know either, but I can just imagine. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, because it's not unbelievable that she would have if she was on drugs.
Right. So when she says this to him, he radioed the police department and he's like, I've got the suspects. I need you to call the Army CID and get someone over here now. Like, I've got them here.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get them down to the station, get them formally questioned. Well, he waited there for over an hour. He sat there in his car and he just waited while they were all, you know, going in and out of the apartment.
Just hanging out.
Yeah. And nobody showed up. He didn't get any sort of backup. So he released them because he couldn't just sit there all night.
Wow.
And he was alone. I mean, he had no backup. He was feeling kind of threatened, like, and so would I. I mean,
absolutely.
He was outnumbered. He was like, I don't know what's going to happen here. So he left. And then months passed. Months. Yeah, months. He contacted Helena again. He wanted to interview her on the record. And he had contacted her many times. And she was unwilling to talk to him, saying, you know, I'm afraid. Well, In 1980, after Dr. McDonald was convicted, he interviewed Helena multiple times over like a 2-year span. And she sang like a canary.
Oh.
Helena told Detective Beasley she had fallen into a hard crowd of servicemen and former servicemen who were really into drugs. Now, Helena came from a really great family, a military family. Her dad was in the military. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, she was like a good person before she fell into this crowd. So some of the people in this group that she fell into was her boyfriend, Greg Mitchell, this black guy named Smitty. And also in the group was a man named Bruce Flowers and a lady named Kathy Smith. Now, this particular group was pissed off at military doctors. They had a beef because they didn't feel like they were treated very well. And some of these military doctors refused to treat them, actually, because they were drug addicts. They were like, look, you need to go get your crap together and like stop wasting my time when I could be helping other people that like are actually ill. And one of these doctors was Dr. McDonald.
Okay, so there's motive. Mm-hmm.
So at some point, this group was like, you know what? We're going over there. We're going to go to his house. We're going to rough him up and we're going to get his cooperation. We're going to threaten him and we're going to say, hey, guy, treat us. Like, I may be ill because I'm an addict.
Give me the drugs.
Yeah. Like, get over it. Just be a doctor and treat me.
Mm-hmm.
So, Detective Beasley interviewed Helena multiple times, like I said. She had married and moved to South Carolina. Yikes. That's where I live. and so at one point he went to South Carolina and interviewed her. At one point he interviewed her in California at the office of Ted Gunderson, who was a special agent with the FBI, but he had gone into private practice at that time. So during these interviews, Helena repeatedly confessed to being at the McDonald home that night. She said she was there. Her boyfriend was there. He was a Vietnam veteran. His name was Greg Mitchell, like I said. Greg also became addicted to heroin while fighting overseas. And Helena, they were just in it too deep. So with each interview, she didn't change her story, but she added to the story. So,
okay.
She said the night of the murders, she and her boyfriend, Greg, Smitty, and this guy, Bruce Flowers, and Kathy Smith went to the McDonald home. And she believed they were just going to rough him up. Now, remember, Dr. McDonald only saw 4 people there. He saw the 3 guys and the 1 girl. Well, Helena says Kathy was there with them that night. She may have been outside, but she says more than 4 people were there that night.
Interesting.
Well, the plan was to go and just talk to him, intimidate him, and rough him up a bit, okay? But Dr. McDonald fought back. So once they got in there, they basically woke him up because he heard his daughter and wife screaming.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. McDonald fought back and things got out of control. She said she stood near the couch holding a candle and she saw Smitty hit Dr. McDonald and called him a pig. At some point during the events, the phone rang and in the McDonald home and she answered the phone. Like she was on drugs. So I don't know what she was thinking answering the phone while a murder was taking place or murders. But one of the guys said, hang up the phone. Like, what are you doing? But not before she actually...
I would like to know who that was that called.
That's what I'm saying. Like, she actually spoke to the person on the line. So whoever was calling to speak to the doctor.
Right.
So she heard Colette calling out for her husband and crying for his help. So she went into the master bedroom to see what was going on. She was like, hey, we're just supposed to be here to, you know, intimidate this guy, talk to him, threaten him. And she saw her boyfriend, Greg Mitchell, on top of Colette beating her with something. She couldn't tell what it was at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
After the murders, she bagged up the clothes she was wearing that night. She did the put the floppy hat, the wig, the boots, some other evidence, and she gave it to a woman named Kathy Perry to hide for her.
Okay.
Kathy gave the bag to a woman named Betty Garcia to hide because she's like, look, I'm not holding this for you. Betty, you hold it. You know, because if the cops come to me, I'm like 1 degree away from Helena. So it was like a game
Exactly.
of hot potato with this evidence. So Detective Beasley interviewed Betty Garcia because he's going down the chain saying, okay, this is the last person who had it. And she verified that she was given a bag of stuff and it was
Okay.
covered in blood. And she said that Kathy's parents, Kathy is the initial person that Helena gave it to. Well, Kathy's
Right.
parents called Betty and said, look, I'm going to need you to destroy that stuff that's in the bag because I think the police might come looking for it and my daughter's fingerprints are going to be on that bag. So I'm going to need you to get rid of that stuff, okay? Well,
Don't tell me she did.
Betty told Detective Beasley she did destroy most of the bloody clothes as requested,
Oh.
but she kept the boots. She was like, these are some cute boots. I'm going to be wearing these on my next date. She also kept a
Oh.
calendar with February 17th circled, which was the
Okay.
night of the murders. No mention of where those were at that point. Like, she didn't produce them, they didn't go into evidence, but she said she kept them. I don't have any information as to, that's one of the rabbit holes I went down that I
Oh,
came
okay.
out of.
Unsatisfied.
So that concludes the declaration by Detective Beasley in 1984. Unfortunately, Helena actually died the year before in 1983 of cirrhosis of the liver. Yeah, it's gonna get you. I guess they were like, eh, she's dead. We've got someone in prison for this. Let's just, let it lie.
No.
Well, Helena didn't just confess repeatedly to being involved in the murders. Her boyfriend, Greg Mitchell, also confessed repeatedly until he died in 1982.
Candace,
Elena.
I'm baffled right now.
Yes. In fact, Anne Sutton Kanaday ran a rehab facility that Greg was a patient at one point in time. He also made a confession there. And three other of his friends came forward and gave sworn affidavits claiming that Greg confessed to them as well.
Okay.
So things are getting strange. Now, Jeffrey's in prison all this time. He married a woman named Catherine in 2002. They had initially met when she wrote him a letter in 1997 saying, hey, I think you're cute and I think you're innocent. They got married. And since they've been together, Catherine has been advocating for Jeffrey's innocence. She's been an integral part of his many appeals. And she actually encouraged him to apply for parole in 2005. He wasn't going to because he was like, no, I'm going to have to go to another hearing. And like, I just, like, this is, it's too much. But he did. She encouraged him to do so. He did. He sought parole, but he was denied. And they were like, and by the way, you can't seek parole again until 2020, which is wild to me. Like, I know some cases where people are up for parole every single year, but they were like, no, you have to wait another 15 years.
Well, and I love how, I mean, it's weird to me that people marry inmates when they're, but God puts people in your
Yeah.
life to advocate for you or for whatever reason.
Right.
And I think it's cool that, I mean, they were put together and she's advocating for him.
Exactly. He also tried to get his case reopened throughout the years. They had evidence. The hands of time had spun, and now we have DNA testing available. And so he's like, listen, there could be evidence that not only exonerates me, but points to the real killer or killers. So in 2007, one of his attorneys, his new attorneys, Harvey Silvergate, I say one of his attorneys because he had more than 20 attorneys over the years.
Wow.
Yeah, he argued that DNA has come so far, something new may come to light through DNA testing that couldn't have been known back in the 70s. So there were two hairs under his daughter's fingernails, and microscopic examination determined that they did not match Jeffrey. That was back in that day. That was just with the things that they had at their disposal back in the 70s when he was at trial. Also in 2007, Greg, Helena's brother, she was with a boyfriend named Greg, but she also had a brother named Greg.
Oh, okay.
He came forward to say that his mother had recently disclosed something to him. Helena didn't just confess to Beasley multiple times. She went to see her mother in 1982. And this was a few months before she died. She had cirrhosis. And she knew her time was short. So it was somewhat of a like deathbed confession. But she told her mother
Okay.
that Dr. McDonald was innocent.
Oh, man.
Greg, her brother, said that his mother truly believed her, like, and really
Yeah.
felt like it was even more sincere because she knew she was gonna die soon.
Yeah.
And she just felt like that was very
Oh, my
sincere.
goodness.
So at this time, Greg contacted Catherine McDonald, Jeffrey's second wife, his new wife. And she had added this information to the website she runs. She also has a website, and put it in his appeal. Well,
Okay.
in all, his case has been put in front of the U.S. Supreme Court 7 times.
Oh,
Seven
wow.
times. His appeals,
Why?
I don't know. His appeals have criticized things like the trial judge and prosecutors, and over 1,000 pieces of evidence that were presented at trial by the prosecution. Also, I don't know if they actually claimed a Brady violation here, but there was also evidence that was withheld. So his appeals have also included the countless people, and I'm not just talking about just hearsay witness, but I'm talking about sworn affidavits from friends that heard
Wow.
Greg and Helena confessed to the murders.
Then what is the issue? Have you seen any of the denials, like what it says, why it's denied, or?
I have read a lot, and
Yeah.
basically they're just saying there's no evidence. There's no sufficient evidence to grant him a new trial. Well, in 2017, People magazine reported that yet another person came forward to report a confession
Okay.
by Greg Mitchell. Actually,
Of
it was a
course.
couple. John and Chris Griffin said that Greg was doing some electrical work in their home between 1981 and 1982, just before Greg died. One day, while on the job, Greg made a tearful confession and expressed great remorse to killing the family, especially when it came to the children. He was very broken up about that, which, like, save your tears is all I have to say.
Yeah.
Chris said, "I believed him. He had this crazy, weird look in his eye and just his whole demeanor while he was at our home working for us. Like, I totally believe that he could have murdered a whole family," which
Yeah.
to that I say, get him off of your property immediately. I don't know exactly what he did, but he said that he tried reaching out to Dr. McDonald's attorneys after Greg died. I guess they were kind of scared of him, so they waited till after he died and then was like, okay, we got to report this. But
Oh, okay.
I don't know what exactly he did to try and reach out, but it slipped through the cracks,
Of
and
course
he
it
was
did.
never able to actually make contact with his attorneys. They came forward again in 2012 after reading some new information about the case in the paper, but it was too late for that particular testimony to be included in his appeal at that time. So we talked about 2017. Well, back in 2014, a judge ruled to deny him a new trial, which he also appealed. And then in 2018, when he was 75, the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that ruling. So he was again denied a new trial. They didn't think new evidence that was presented, which was that those three hairs from the scene, which, by the way, at this point they had DNA tested and it was confirmed that those three hairs didn't match anyone in the family, not the victims and not Jeffrey.
You've got to be kidding me.
But the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals didn't think that that was sufficient to warrant a new trial, so his hopes were dashed again.
I don't feel like they're even reading any of these appeals. They're just like, nope.
Yeah.
Pass on.
And you know what? I saw that most of these appeals were denied by the same trial judge. And I'm like,
oh,
how is that even allowed?
Right. Is that legal?
I don't know. Well, that was one of the many things that the defense was calling out. Like, this is prejudice. Like, this is obviously. Uh-huh. So his attorney also tried to get him released under the compassionate release program, citing his age and his failing health and the fact that he'd already served 40 years. Well, unfortunately for him, the new criteria for the compassionate release program applies to crimes that took place after 1987. And since he was convicted in 1979, the old sentencing applies to him and he is not eligible.
Oh, man.
But he's had a number of supporters over the years and they firmly believe his innocence. Colette's family still very much believes he is guilty. And then the most recent thing that happened in the case was that Jeffrey was going to request release again in 2021, just last year, but he canceled that request. That's the last thing that's happened in the case. And I don't know why he chose to cancel the request.
Right.
But I just have to think at this point, for the last 30 plus years, every time you've tried to plead your innocence, that they just aren't having it.
Yeah. So, and you're fighting for your life. Like, you're
exactly.
You can't live your life in prison. That's just really sad to me.
Yeah. So, like I said, Fatal Vision was the title of the best-selling crime book in the 80s. Well, they also made a television miniseries about the case. I, of course, didn't watch it because if it's based on the book, then it's going to be very theatrical and salacious and obviously is going to be more entertainment than fact.
Oh, right.
I didn't want to separate reality from the situation.
Gotcha.
But I have been so torn about this case.
Yeah.
The most sensational version of the story is that this guy was very successful, but he ran around on his wife, then murdered his whole family so he could just do whatever he wants, right? Like a Chris Watts type of thing.
Yeah, that's the kind of stories we hear.
Yeah. And it's the most shocking, the most whatever, right. Like the husband did it. It's the easiest to get to. To suggest the possibility of his innocence would admit that the evidence suggesting it was someone else was ignored, which is,
well,
a very dangerous thing to suggest, right?
Right. And I feel like it was ignored. You have all these people trying to tell you and you're not trying to investigate any part of it.
Exactly. And they kept saying, well, they're drug addicts. They'll say anything. And I'm like,
right.
Like, okay, there's such thing as conformity. You know, it's human nature, like in psychology. Let me just get really nerdy for just a minute. Just humor me. You know, conformity is when we say something we know is not true, but just so we can fit in. We've all been in sixth grade or fifth grade, and we've all like said we started our period when we didn't, just because we think that's what, you know, that's what someone wants to hear. We just want to fit in.
Right.
And this is not coerced confession either. We have, you know, coerced confession, things that are said under duress. And then there's somebody who repeatedly keeps saying that they murdered a family and telling everybody they know that they did this. Okay?
Right.
Then there's multiple people who keep suggesting this is true separately. The, and mind
Yeah,
you,
there's this
Helena,
bag of evidence with
exactly,
boots still
the
in the mix.
he was able to track down that person, like the name of the
Yeah.
person. It was so specific.
There was truth to the story.
Right. But if you suggest this possibility that someone else could have done it, then, well, we've got to look into that. And, you know,
Right.
it's been so many years later.
Right.
Let's just not have to do that work. Jeffrey's very first attorney, Bernard Siegel, said that, quote, "The country tromps on him because a handful of players decided that their place in the sun is linked to destroying him. It's everything we worry about in our government come true," end quote. And that is a person's worst nightmare. That is the ultimate nightmare. That the thought that you could be imprisoned for the rest of your life, or even put to death for a crime that you didn't commit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The reason it took me so long to wrangle this case together, to conclude this story, was because I was poring over case documents, trial transcripts, DNA testing, and I was like, what am I missing? There's got to be something here that is going to push me in one direction. Like, where is the actual physical evidence against Dr. McDonald? Like, the circumstantial evidence, like, it's not even damning enough for me to follow that down to a guilty verdict for him. You said, let's talk it out. So I want to talk it out. You're probably like, wait a minute. Didn't you just talk it out? No, but I think it's really important to go through the evidence here, okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
The physical evidence against him, we had the fibers from his shirt that was in his room under his wife's body and in his children's bed. Well, he admittedly was in those places, and I can find an innocent explanation
That's
for
what I was thinking
why those
when
fibers.
You were saying, when you were saying they found all these things, I'm thinking, yeah, he said he went in there, yeah.
Right. I can see why that footprint of his was in blood. I mean, he went into those rooms. He stepped in blood, I'm sure. This is not a discrepancy in his story, and it's not proof that he committed the crimes either. He says that he found his family murdered, and it makes sense that he would have stepped in blood at some point. Now, the murder weapons coming from the house also doesn't prove that he is the one who used
that
them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Helena Stokely said they just went in there to rough him up and things got out of control. So maybe these were weapons of convenience. Maybe they just were getting anything they could find in the house. No evidence of a bunch of people that were in there that night. Okay. Well, that doesn't seem to be evidence that he's guilty. That's more speculatory if you think about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you think it seems like four other people wouldn't have been in there. They also brought up the fact that there were no muddy footprints at the scene and it was raining that night. So like there would have had to have been. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, when did it start raining? Did it rain after, like when everyone was coming on scene? Also, remember the crime scene was not secure. And like 20 some odd people, nearly 30 people were going in and out of that crime scene. And they still say there was no muddy footprints.
Interesting.
So did everyone just wear booties? Or just because there were no muddy footprints at the scene does not mean there were no people in there.
Exactly.
And to that point, if there was almost 30 people going through the crime scene, and you're going to say that four people couldn't have been there because the crime scene was not very disturbed, but there was nearly 30 people in there. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the crime scene still wasn't disturbed. That argument doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, weapons of convenience, no evidence that a bunch of people was there. I can't get behind those things. The fact that the hairs didn't match anyone. Obviously, that couldn't have been known at the time of the trial. because of DNA testing, but it certainly is grounds for a new trial, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, so there's more evidence against him that I can reconcile. So his injuries, or lack thereof, of fatal injuries. They're saying that he self-inflicted all these injuries. Well, he's a doctor. Would he have inflicted an injury that would have collapsed one of his lungs?
Right.
I'm just wondering, like, if these injuries were so superficial, wouldn't they actually be superficial? And going back to Helena's reported confession that they were just there to rough him up, what's worse than murdering someone? The worst than murdering someone is murdering their entire family and leaving them alive.
And leaving them alive, right.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Again, I'm speculating here. These are things that I'm trying to rationalize in my mind. Or maybe the people that were in the living room were roughing him up, and the people that were murdering the family, maybe they got their wires crossed and they didn't really communicate what they were supposed to do there. I don't know.
Right. And it's sad to me also because Colette's family really thinks that he did it because of the way he's acting. Maybe, I don't know if anybody's mentioned this, but maybe he hired them to do this murder, because if there really was trouble in paradise and he wanted to get rid of them.
Yeah, you know,
I don't know.
I never saw any reports or inkling that was a suggestion. They basically suggested that he's the one who did it. It was by his hands.
Well, to me, in my opinion, it really sounds like he didn't do it, and it was Helena and her buddies. But if he is at all guilty, I would think that maybe he hired these people to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the main things that sticks out to me is the fact that the corroboration by Detective Beasley, who saw them that night wearing the exact same stuff that Jeffrey described.
Right. Exactly.
Detective Beasley would have seen them before the murders. So he sees them before the murders wearing whatever they're wearing. Jeffrey would have been at the scene at a separate time explaining what they're wearing. Did Detective Beasley and Jeffrey McDonald get together and compare notes? No, because that was two separate occasions, same people, same clothing. So explain that, please. That there's just too much reasonable doubt. Now, there is one thing I can't understand. There was none of Jeffrey's blood found in the living room. He was supposedly hit over the head, stabbed multiple times, and he didn't bleed there. I don't know.
If he went, did he fall to the, I can't remember if you said he fell to the floor or did he immediately run? You said he collapsed in the, going up those two steps.
Yeah, he was attacked in the living room and he got up and tried to fight them off, and they ended up bashing him over the head, stabbing him a little bit, and he fell to the floor in, like, right on those steps. So it could be that there was some of his blood in the living room. They just didn't pick up on it. Maybe it was trace amounts. Maybe it was droplets. And they just weren't seeing that because it wasn't obvious. Or maybe they had a one-track mind.
They had already made up their mind.
Yeah. I don't know what happened there. I get why the jury convicted him. If I was a juror and I'm sitting in there and I'm getting the information that they got at the time, and I'm seeing the trial judge rolling his eyes, basically showing, you know, prejudice against the defense, I get it. But I don't get why he wasn't granted a new trial, because scientific proof showed that someone else was there, or multiple people were there that night.
Right.
I'm usually one of those people that can easily make up their mind about someone's guilt or innocence, like looking at the evidence. But like I said, this one twisted my melon. Yeah.
You wanted to have an answer.
I want to find something that says, oh yeah, well, it's really screwing with me. I also don't know that he's totally innocent either. Like, I just, I am just so teetering on there's reasonable doubt, but also why didn't anyone track these other people down that were confessing to the murders? I don't understand. Like, this has just really screwed me up.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, just what I said a while ago, that if I was a juror in his case, listening to what you just laid out for us, I would say that it was Helena and her friends. But the fact that Colette's family is set on him being guilty, and because of his actions and because of how he was acting in the interviews and stuff, I mean, that is a little sketchy. But yeah, I'm with you. I would like to know why these appeals are being, they're not being approved. Are they being read? That's frustrating.
Yeah, it just seems like someone's phoning it in and saying, no, just hit deny. Like telling his secretary, okay, the next one that comes in, just deny that one too. You know, just like it just seems that the judge was so biased, or the Court of Appeals was just like, oh my God, the Jeffrey McDonald case again.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll close by bringing it back to the victims of this horrific tragedy. Colette was a beautiful, she was only 26 at the time of her death. Just a lovely woman. She was in the prime of her lime, as Chandler Bing would say. She had two beautiful girls, a son on the way. They are all buried in Washington Memorial Park in Suffolk County in New York. Those babies never got to experience life.
Right.
Colette never got to meet her son that was growing inside her. And this is just, I'm baffled by this. I'm curious to know what our listeners think about this case, because it has seemed pretty 50-50 in the court of public opinion over the years. Like, there's obviously Colette's side, and then the CID, they all think he's guilty. But then the other side thinks, well, there's just too much reasonable doubt. He still has adamant supporters, but Colette's family still think he's guilty. And I get it. Listen, that's your family. And when someone, your emotions are involved. And if your daughter's husband is cheating on her, that pisses me off too. Okay. If he's smiling in an interview while he's talking about your dead daughter, I get that. Like, that is, but that does not a murderer make. So I get the emotion. And the website I was telling you about, the one the family put together, while it does have tons of facts and like accurate information from the courts and everything, a lot of the writings that were done by like the blog posts and stuff from her family were very, very against Dr. McDonald. So anyway, that's the story of the McDonald family slayings. I wish I had some pretty bow to wrap things up in and say, look, the people really responsible are paying for it. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, I just really don't think he did it ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you did a great job at giving us the story and giving us the facts. And
I honestly am glad to be done with this case. This is really, I haven't been sleeping very well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anyways, I'm going to go smoke my fake cigarette because I need to really chill after this. Thank y'all for hanging in there. If you're still listening, if you're not, then I'm not thanking you because you're not listening to this. So check us out on Instagram. I'll be posting photos of the victims and the crime scene, you know, nothing graphic, but check us out.
On it's Cousins on Crime podcast on Instagram.
Yeah, and hit us up on Gmail.
CousinsOnCrime@gmail.com.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye now.